just by way of introduction, when Israel came out of Egypt, they crossed over the Red Sea at some point, and they headed down to Mount Sinai to get the Ten Commandments and how to build the tabernacle. And in no time at all, they headed up to go into the Promised Land. It should only have taken them a few weeks. And they got to this place, Kadesh Barnea. So this is now on the border of the Promised Land, which is full of Canaanites, Hittites, Hivites, and all those ites who don't want them to come into the land. And at that point, they send the 12 spies in. The 12 spies go in, have a look round, come back, and they say, 10 of them say, oh, this is terrible, we can't do it. Two of them say, let's go, Joshua and Caleb. And at that point, they make a decision not to enter into the rest and the peace and the joy of the land, but to turn back and wander around the desert for 40 years till every last one of them was dead, except for Joshua and Caleb. And then eventually, the Lord said, you've gone around this mountain long enough. And they went up on the other side of Jordan, crossed over the River Jordan, entered into Jericho. Bob was doing the story of Jericho. And then they conquered the land 40 years later. Now, that story of them getting to a certain point and then turning back is the whole background to this passage. And it's a brilliant story for the writer of Hebrews to tell, because 1,500 years later, Jesus dies, the gospel goes out, the Jews get saved, and instead of going on and really enjoying all the blessings of being saved, they're thinking, do you know what? This is too hard. We can't do this. We're being excluded socially. We're losing our jobs. Why don't we just go back? So this is a true story what happened here, but it's also a parable for what's happening here. People that have been saved, they've been baptized, they're heading into all the blessings and going to, and then they're going to turn back. So let's just read the first 11 verses, chapter 4, and then work our way through it. So this warning section actually started in chapter 3, verse 7. So we're still in the middle of this warning section, which runs on to chapter 4, verse 13. So let's read the first 11 verses of chapter 4. Take heed, therefore, let us therefore fear, lest a promise being left us of entering into God's rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. For unto us was the gospel preached, as well as unto them. But the word preached did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in them that heard it. Let's just... For we which have believed do enter into rest, as he said, as I have sworn in my wrath, if they shall enter into my rest, although the works were finished from the foundation of the world. For he, God, spoke in a certain place of the seventh day of this on this wise, and God did rest the seventh day from all his works, and in this place again, if they shall enter in my rest. Seeing therefore it remaineth that some must enter therein, and they to whom it was first preached entered not, because of unbelief, again, he limiteth a certain day, saying in David, today, after so long a time as it is said, today if you'll hear his voice, harden not your heart. For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not afterward have spoken of another day. There remaineth therefore a rest to the people of God. For he that is entered into his rest, he also has ceased from his own works as God did from his. Let us labour therefore to enter into that rest, lest any man fall after the same example of unbelief. Now come back please to Psalm 95. In my head I have a few sort of key dates that I just kind of memorised a few years ago. Whenever I think of the children of Israel coming out of Egypt, I always think 1,500 years before Christ. I've just memorised that one. In the Newbury margin it says 1,491. So I just think 1,500 years, that's Moses, that's Israel coming out of Egypt. Then I think of King David and Solomon and the Psalms and all that as 1,000 years before Christ. This is rough. So what we're about to read in Psalm 95, which is written by David, was written 1,000 years before Christ, whereas the children of Israel came out of Egypt 1,500 years before Christ. So, there's a gap of 500 years between Israel not going into the land and this psalm being written. A 500 year gap. We just read in Hebrews, after such a long time. So I'm just telling you how long that time is. It's 500 years. Now look at Psalm 95 verse 7, last sentence of verse 7. This is King David, 1,000 years before Christ. Today, if you, people that could hear David, the Jews of David's day, if you will hear his voice, harden not your heart, as in the provocation, 500 years ago. As in the day of temptation in the wilderness, 500 years ago. When your fathers tempted me, proved me and saw my work, 40 long years was I grieved with that generation. And I said, it's a people that do err in the heart, and they've not known my ways, unto whom I swear in my wrath, they will not enter into my rest. So what is happening here, just bear with me and then we'll get to Hebrews. What's happening here is, this has happened, it's gone, it's 500 years ago, it's as far long ago as the Reformation is to us. It's ancient history, it's Henry VIII to us, a long time ago. 500 years later, David pops up and says, today, if you'll hear his voice. So when the spies came back from going round the land, they said, today, if you'll hear his voice, let's go. And they said, no, we're going to harden our hearts. 500 years later, David says, today, if you'll hear his voice. In other words, although they missed out back then, David is saying, God's still got rest for you if you'll hear his voice, even now. Now, that's a key point. You won't understand Hebrews 4 unless you understand that. That the offer of rest, which they refused, is still hanging. It's still available. Because David offers them rest, if they will obey his voice, 500 years later. Nothing to do with going into the land. They're already in the land. But this offer of rest is what God wants to give to people. Now, come back to Hebrews chapter 4. Because what we're going to discover is this. God wants to give us rest. And he wants to give the Hebrews rest. So, let's look at verse 1. Let us therefore fear. Now, if you study Hebrews for any length of time, you're going to find quite a few of these let us. There's a brother in Northern Ireland, he was a submariner during the war, and he was a character, tattoos and everything, and he got saved by the grace of God. And one morning he got up in the morning and he says, I want to speak to you on lettuces this morning. And everybody wondered what was he talking about. It was going to be the lettuces of Hebrews, not lettuces, but the lettuces. Lots of these lettuces. So here's one in verse 1. Let us therefore fear. Look at verse 11. Let us labor. Look at verse 14. Let us hold fast. Look at verse 16. Let us come boldly. So these are what we call exhortations. So a rebuke is when you tell someone off. But an exhortation is when you encourage someone. And of course, both of those are used in Hebrews. So here's the exhortation. Let us fear. Let us be wary, lest a promise being left us of entering into his rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. So, what he's saying is this. Back in the days of Israel, they got a promise of entering into rest. But they didn't enter into rest. But that promise is still left. It hasn't gone away. That promise is being left to us. Of entering into God's rest. And so the bottom line in the exhortation is, don't do what your fathers did. They could have gone into the rest and they turned back. Unbelief robbed them of the rest that they could have had. So let us fear. You Hebrews in the first century who are having such a hard time now that you've got saved, don't make the same mistake that they did and miss out by unbelief and go back. Now, Where did they want to go back to back in that day? Remember they said, why did we leave Egypt? We want to go back to Egypt. The leeks and the onions and the garlics are much better than this manna. We want to go back to Egypt. Now, where are they going back to here? They're not going back to Egypt. Going back to Egypt is an illustration of them going back to the temple, going back to the sacrifices, going back to this system of Judaism who's just crucified Jesus. So it's not backsliding, it's apostasy. It's saying, I made a mistake, I don't believe in Jesus anymore, I'm going back to have fellowship with the people that crucified him. Now, in verse 1 it says, this promise is left to us. Look down to verse 6, a very similar expression. Seeing therefore it remains. Look down to verse 9, there remaineth therefore a rest. So let's just imagine a very, very simple illustration. We're probably going to have some birthday cake later on today. And maybe it won't be finished. Probably will be, but maybe it won't. And if it's not finished, somebody might put it in a cupboard. And next week, unless some little rodents have found it in the meantime, that cake is still available next week. There's some left. It hasn't gone away. It's still there. Some left. So what the writer is saying is this. The children of Israel were promised rest. They got to the land and said, we don't want it, we're going away. Now God didn't say, okay, that's it, cancel the rest. God said, no, I still want to give humanity rest. I still want to give my people rest. So it's still there. It still remains. It's still left. It's gone begging, as it were. But the promise of rest still stands. So, look at verse 2. What do you make of verse 2? Unto us was the gospel preached as well as unto them. So here's a question for you to keep you awake. Who preached the gospel to these people back in the time of Egypt? You say, I don't remember a gospel meeting in Exodus. Was there a gospel meeting in Exodus? Well, it says here, unto us was the gospel preached as well as unto them. You say, well, sure the gospel wasn't even a thing back then. I mean, we heard the gospel that we're sinners and Christ died for us and salvation is through faith. I don't remember them hearing the gospel. But it says it is they did hear the gospel. You say, well, when did they hear the gospel? Well, what does gospel mean? Gospel means good news. So if you think of it in terms of good news, when did they hear good news? Well, do you remember when they were in Egypt? Moses came to them and he said to them, I've got a message from God for you. I will bring you out of Egypt and I will bring you into the land. Well, that was good news, wasn't it? That was the gospel. That was the good news that they heard, that God was going to deliver them and save them, and they were to believe that message. Now, the Bible says they did believe it when they saw him do the rod into a snake and so on. And they left Egypt having believed this gospel. A few weeks later, they get to Kadesh Barnea. And the spies go in and they come back and say, two of them say, we can do this. It's a great land. It's wonderful. Let's go. And they turn around and said, no, we're going back. So here's the question. Did they really believe? When they were told, I'll bring you out and I'll bring you in. Well, God brought them out. That's half of the promise fulfilled. But when they got to Kadesh Barnea, they're like, not sure about the second part. Yeah, he brought us out, but we don't think he can bring us in. That was unbelief. God was actually angry with them. He swore with an oath in his wrath, okay, fine, you will not enter into my rest. Your carcasses will die in the wilderness. So look at verse 2 again. Unto us was the gospel preached, so you heard the gospel, you believers here this afternoon when you got saved, so did they. But the word that was preached unto them by Moses about going into the land, it didn't profit them. They might as well never have heard it. Not being mixed with faith in them that heard it. So when someone hears the gospel, let's say someone comes to the gospel meeting tonight, they walk in the door, they hear the gospel, but they don't believe it. And they turn around and go away. They might as well never have heard it. It hasn't done them any good. It hasn't profited them. So, they were to believe the gospel in Egypt. They were delivered on the Passover night. They passed through the Red Sea. They went via Sinai up to Kadesh Barnea. They started well. It looked like they believed. It looked like they were going to make it. Well, they said they believed. But when they got to Kadesh Barnea, turns out that they didn't really believe at all. And they actually wanted to go back to Egypt. So Paul, the writer here, is thinking of these Christians. He says, whoa, so similar to what happened back then. So similar. These people have got saved. Well, they say they have. And they've been baptized. And they've come into the assembly. And they've done pretty well. They've gone on all right. But I think some of them are going to go back. They're going to deny that Jesus is God. They're going to deny that the sacrifice of the cross was an atonement for their sins. They're going to tread underfoot the Son of God. They're going to count the blood a common thing. They're going to go back. And he says to himself, do you know what that will prove? That will prove these people never were saved in the first place. Now, look at verse 3. For we which have believed do enter into rest, as he said. Now, this is where it gets tricky. We which have believed do enter into rest. That is in the present tense. You say, what's the present tense? It means it's happening now. It's not in the future. It's not it will. It's not in the past. It's not it has. It's do. It's in the present tense. So, he's not saying we have entered into rest. He's not even saying we will enter into rest. Which is very difficult to get your head around, because if you read the commentators, some people sort of say, well, it means we have entered and being saved is all the rest you need. And other people say, well, it's all in the future. But it doesn't say have and it doesn't say will. It says do. So I think it might be wise, and it might be correct, to sort of split the difference. Let me read to you a commentator called Homer Kent on this verse. Are you listening? He's talking about this expression, we which have believed do enter into rest. It should be regarded as a statement of present experience, in which true believers presently enjoy rest, to a certain extent, while at the same time looking forward to a glorious consummation in the life to come. So when you got saved, did you enter into rest? Well, yes, you did. I know people say it's not the same word in Matthew 10:28 and all that, but I can't help think that when we got saved, we entered into rest. Come unto me, all you that labour, and I'll give you rest. You know, before you were saved, what were you like? You were restless. The wicked are like the troubled sea. They cannot rest. People are very restless. When you get saved, you come into a rest of conscience, rest of soul, rest of heart, and so on. But we're not fully at rest, are we? We still have stresses. We still have troubles. We still have difficulties. We still have bereavements and illnesses. And we long to be out of this troubled world and completely at rest. So some people translate verse 4 like this. We which have believed are sure to enter into rest. Other people translate it, we who have believed are in the process of entering into rest. So it's like we're enjoying rest at the moment in principle. We know we're saved and we're at peace with God and we've got the rest and joy of salvation. But we know that there's a full realization of that rest in the life which is to come. So look back to the text, verse 3. He now quotes Psalm 95 again. As I sworn in my wrath, if they shall enter into my rest, or really that should be translated, they shall not enter in my rest. It's exactly the same as the verse 18 of the previous chapter. And then, out of the blue, this is why this chapter is so complicated, out of the blue, he introduces a random topic which he's never mentioned before. Look at Look at the end of verse 3. Although the works were finished from the foundation of the world. For God spake in a certain place of the seventh day on this wise, God did rest the seventh day from all his labours. Now how about that for a sidewinder? You're in the desert. You've just got your head around the desert story. And you've tied that to the Hebrews. And you think, oh, I really understand this now. They were going to need a rest, and we've got the rest, and we're going to have a full rest. And then all of a sudden, he starts talking about creation, and you think, where did that come from? Well, it seems a bit of a jolt, but what he's doing is introducing a sort of big thought behind even what happened back in the days of Egypt. So let's plot a little journey. Here's where we are here. Here's Egypt, and here's creation. So when you get saved, you get rest. And eventually in heaven and in the millennial kingdom, that rest will be in its full bloom with nothing to disturb it. So that's the glory of rest that we get through Christ. There's a picture of that in Egypt when they could have had rest in Israel, but they missed out on it. But if you go back to the beginning of creation, you'll find that God rested. So we are resting and will fully rest one day. Israel was offered a rest. But if you go back to the beginning, the first person who ever rested was God. Now this is absolutely fascinating. I'm going to ask you to look back to chapter 3. Look in verse 11. What is the rest called? Chapter 3, verse 11, my rest. Look at chapter 3, verse 18. What is the rest called? My rest. Look at chapter 4, verse 1. What is it called? His rest, i.e. God's rest. Look at chapter 4, verse 3. What is it called? My rest. Look at verse 5. What is it called? My rest. Look at verse 10. What is it called? His rest. You say, well, now you've lost me. I thought this was all about me resting, or the children of Israel resting. You know, I can understand Canaan rest. Now you want me to understand creation rest. Surely that's two totally different things. Well, it is and it isn't. God spent 6 days forming and filling his creation. And when he'd done it, he sat back and ceased working and rested. He wasn't tired, he wasn't exhausted, but he ceased working and he looked at it all and said, it's very good and I'm now enjoying my rest and surveying the scene. Everything is perfect. Now this is God's rest. This is God's peace. This is God's joy. Now says God, I want you to enter into my rest. I don't want you to be fighting on the battlefields of Kharkiv. I don't want you to be bombing each other in Gaza. I don't want there to be abuse and disease and tears and death. I want my creation to enjoy peace and rest. And so he put Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden and said, have fellowship with me and enjoy the rest of creation. And they said, oh no, we won't. We're going to sin. We're going to bring disaster into world history. And so what happened was this. God's rest, which he wanted to share with mankind, was wrecked and ruined by sin. I think I quoted that verse to you earlier on. The wicked are like the troubled sea that cannot rest. From the moment Adam and Eve sinned, planet Earth became a restless, troubled place. If you work in the health service or in the education system or any of those kind of professions, you know the world is a restless place. It is a troubled place. A very troubled place. It goes back to the Garden of Eden. And if you talk to the average person who's walking down Marketplace in Chalfont this afternoon, you might even notice a furrowed brow and a burdened look about them, because humanity is troubled. It is not enjoying God's rest. Life is a struggle. Life is an uphill battle. Life is one disaster after another, one sorrow after another, and it ends with disease and death. You say it's a terrible black picture. Yes, it is. We're not enjoying God's rest. It has all gone terribly wrong. So, 1500 years later, God said, okay, let's start again. I will offer you rest. You've messed up. Mankind has not had rest. We've had the flood and the Tower of Babel, and we've had an absolute trauma for all these centuries. But I'm going to choose a people. I'm going to bring them into rest. And when they get into that land, a group of people will be enjoying my rest like nobody's done since the Garden of Eden. And they messed up. They said, we don't want your rest. We want to go back to Egypt. So imagine, God offered Adam and Eve rest in the Garden of Eden. They said, let's just go and do our own thing, and they messed up. 1500 years later, God offers the children of Israel rest, and they say, we don't want it either. So you would think at that point, God would say, do you know what? Forget this. I'm not going to offer anybody else any more rest ever again, because human beings don't seem to want rest. But when you look into verse 5, he says, and in this place again, if they shall enter into my rest. This is a quote from Psalm 95. So let's put all this together before we wrap up. God created the world and rested and wanted Adam and Eve to join in that rest. They said, we don't want that rest. We want to do our own thing. And the world was plunged into sin. 1500 years later, God said, that rest is still available. And I want the children of Israel to come into that rest. And they said, we don't want that rest. We're going to wander around the desert and rebel. 500 years later, King David writes Psalm 95. And he says to the children of Israel, who by that stage were in the land, today, if you will hear his voice, harden not your heart. Now, the fact that David wrote that, that today you can hear my voice, today you can enter into my rest, what does it prove? Look at verse 6. Seeing, therefore, it remains that some must enter therein. And they to whom it was first preached entered not in because of unbelief. Again, he limits. Now, the word limit there is not to put a limit on a thing like, you know, turn that oven down to 2. It's not that kind of a limit. The idea of limiting there is to mark out a day, fix it or appoint it. So in Psalm 95 that we read, David is fixing a certain day. What day was it? It was the day in which he lived. 1,000 years before Christ. A new day has arrived. Rest is available. I'm preaching it to you. These people missed out, but it's available to you today. Look at verse 7. After so long a time. From here to David was 500 years. Isn't that gracious? Would you stand and wait and give an offer of rest? Would you wait 1,500 years and give that offer to Israel? And when they didn't want it, wait another 500 years and give another offer? What a patient God we have. He's willing to offer rest. And still they didn't enter into his rest. Look at verse 8. This is just sort of backing up his argument. Before we look at verse 8, let me raise an objection. So you're a Jew, you're listening to Paul's argument, to the writer's argument here, and you're thinking, right, okay. He's arguing that our forefathers didn't enter into rest, and he wants us now to enter into rest. So that's his argument. But that's a silly argument. Because the fact of the matter is, yes, they wandered in the desert for 40 years, but they did get into the land eventually. So what's this whole thing about the offer went begging and now it's available again? That's a silly argument. They got into the land in the end. So he said, no, hang on a minute. Look at verse 8. if Joshua had really given them rest, Psalm 95 would never have been written. If they'd really got rest in the land when they finally got in, why would God have spoken of another day, of another opportunity? You see, when they got into the land, did they really have rest? Well, they slaughtered the Jerichoites and the kings of whatever, the five kings in the cave and all that. But ultimately, when they got up a bit further north, they thought, you know what, we're tired of fighting. Let's just charge them a bit of tax. And they left this and they left that. And then eventually Solomon decided he would marry some of the people from these other nations. And then eventually the Assyrians came and the Babylonians came and they didn't really have rest. So the writer said, I know what you're saying. They did eventually get into the land. But really, if you honestly look back at the history of God's people in the Old Testament, they never really had the rest that God wanted. So whether it's Adam and Eve in the garden or the children of Israel throughout their whole history, if you stand back and look at the whole thing, do you know what you have to say? There's not much rest in it anywhere. Now listen to verse 9. There remaineth, therefore, a rest to the people of God. Aha! This is where you come in Chalfont St. Peter today. The rest went begging in Eden. The rest went begging in Kadesh Barnea. The rest went begging when David offered it. Now, says the writer, God hasn't changed his mind. He wants to give rest. He wants to give peace. He wants to give blessing. All these people have turned their back on it. What about you? Are you going to turn your back on it? Are you going to go back to the temple and say, well, you know, I like the sound of the gospel and all that, and it's a great idea, but it's costing me too much. And I'm going to go back to a system which, number one, has been finished by God, and number two, crucified Jesus Christ. I'm going to go back to it. He says, don't go back. Don't go back. Enter into the rest. Now, he says in verse 10, he that has entered into his rest, he also has ceased from his own works, as God did from his. Now, that's another very difficult verse. Now, there are two main ways of looking at this verse. Some people say that, okay, back at the Garden of Eden, God worked for 6 days and then he stopped and he took a rest. He ceased from his works. And when you got saved, you used to try and work your way to heaven, but when you got saved, you stopped doing those works and you rested. I don't think that's quite right. I'll tell you why I don't think it's right. When God worked for 6 days and then rested, he was ceasing from works of his own and then resting. When we got saved, we were not ceasing as God ceased. His works were perfect and then he rested. Our works were a mess. We actually abandoned our own works and trusted in the work of Christ. So what I think this verse is actually saying is this. When a person ceases from work, they rest. So you go to work 4 or 5 days a week, perhaps, or you work all week with your kids or whatever you do. And at the end, when you've finished all your works, you sit down and you take a rest. That's exactly what God did in the Garden of Eden. So what I think he's saying is this. When we get to heaven, when we get to the great millennial kingdom, when we get to that final new age to come, that's when we will fully enter into rest. There's a hymn. When all my labours and trials are o'er, and when I'm safe on that beautiful shore. Now, just think of that first line. When all my labours and trials are o'er. When you come to Revelation chapter 14, verse 13, it talks about those that are going to be in heaven one day, and it says this. They rest from their labours. You see that word rest in verse 9? It's not the same word as all the other times you got rest. It's actually a unique word. Some people say that the writer made it up. It's the only time it occurs in the whole of the New Testament. Let me pronounce it to you in Greek. So this is the verse 9. There remaineth therefore a rest. That word rest in Greek is sabbatismos. Sabbatismos. What does that sound like to you? Sabbatismos. Well, the sixth day of the week in the Jewish calendar was a Sabbath. A Sabbath. It was the day of rest. So what he's saying is this. There remains, because of the fact that no one has really taken up God on his offer of rest all the, through the centuries, there remains a Sabbath rest. There remains a Sabbath celebration when the whole of creation will finally rest. No more tornadoes, no more tsunamis, no more earthquakes, no more COVID, no more death, no more disaster. There will be a glorious rest available to the people of God. And when we finally enter into that rest, the fullness of it, no more visits to the chiropractor, no more visits to the eye clinic, no more visits to the, no more pills. Wouldn't that be a happy day? No more backache, no more, oh, it's Monday morning again. Here we go, hamster on a wheel. Got to go and do, you know, pay all the bills. Just that whole sense of living in a world racked by restlessness and weariness. One day, it's going to be all over. We're going to enter into this sabbatismos, this eternal, glorious celebration of rest. Just like God rested, we're going to rest. It's his rest, and we're going to enter into his rest. These people failed to enter in. In David's day, they failed to enter in. Adam and Eve didn't want to enter in. But you and I, one day, we have rest in our hearts now. We've begun to rest. We do rest. But we're going to fully enter into that rest in a coming day. Now, 2 minutes. Verse 11, we'll finish. Let us labor. Now, it sounds a bit strange to ask someone to labor and to rest, doesn't it? Labor and rest seem like opposites. Well, that word labor is not the word, it just means to give diligence to. Maybe a modern translation would say something like, let us be diligent. Let us, somebody got a different translation there? Let us strive. Yes, let us make sure, let us be earnest. So what he's saying is this. I'm worried about you lot. You say you're saved. You come to the meetings. But you're wobbling. And you might go back. And I've tried my best to tell you. To warn you not to go back. To tell you what a disaster it was for them when they went back. They missed out on God's rest. So what he's really saying to these people is, if you go back, I'm sorry, that it's not just a matter of a little bit of backsliding. To actually repudiate Christ and go back to Judaism, you're never going to be in heaven. You're never going to be in the glorious kingdom. You don't have rest in your hearts, and you won't have rest in the eternal home. Let us be absolutely sure that we really are saved, that we're going to enter into this rest, lest anybody falls after the same example of unbelief. So this is the sort of wrap up now. These people came out of Egypt, down to Sinai, up to Kadesh, and they didn't go in. And what did they do? They went round in the desert, chapter 3, verse 17, and their carcasses fell. Imagine, somebody worked out how many funerals a day it was. From memory, it was 40 funerals a day, but I may be wrong. 2 million people came out of Egypt. All of those over a certain age died in 40 years. You can work out, that's a lot of funerals. Their carcasses just fell in the wilderness. He says, listen, I don't want you to fall like they did and miss out. Let us be diligent. Let us give proof, he says to them, of the reality of our salvation, in that we press on and fully enter in and eventually fully enter in to his rest. A little bit of a tricky passage, but I hope it has been a little bit where you're getting the handle on it and beginning to get the concept of it, because it is a glorious passage despite its difficulties. And thank the Lord that we will one day enter fully into the rest that we have in Christ. So let's pray.